So, if you're willing, we can
I am.
start. And maybe the best way to start would be with a reading.
Sure.
Thank
Just
you.
cue me when you're ready.
Go ahead. You can just, if you would introduce it yourself, let us know what it is. We may or may not use your introduction, but it would be nice to have it.
How much do you want me to say?
Just enough to get us into it.
Okay. This is the opening of my book, The Shining Girls. It's Harper, the serial killer, in 17 July 1974, and it's his first meeting with our heroine, Kirby. He clenches the orange plastic pony in the pocket of his sports coat. It is sweaty in his hand. Midsummer here, too hot for what he's wearing, but he has learned to put on a uniform for this purpose, jeans in particular. He takes long strides, a man who walks because he's got somewhere to be, despite his gimpy foot. Harper Curtis is not a moocher, and time waits for no one, except when it does. The girl is sitting cross-legged on the ground, her bare knees white and bony as bird skulls and grass-stained. She looks up at the sound of his boots scrunching on the gravel, but only long enough for him to see that her eyes are brown under that tangle of grubby curls, before she dismisses him and goes back to her business. "What are you doing?" he says, putting brightness in his voice. He crouches down beside her in the threadbare grass. Really, he's never seen a child with such crazy hair, like she got spun around in her own personal dust devil, one that tossed up the assortment of random junk splayed around her. A cluster of rusty tin cans, a broken bicycle wheel tipped on its side, spokes jabbing outwards. Her attention is focused on a chipped teacup, turned upside down so that the silvered flowers on the lip disappear into the grass. The handle is broken off, leaving two blunt stumps. "You having a tea party, sweetheart?" he tries again. "It's not a tea party," she mutters into the petal-shaped collar of her checked shirt. Kids with freckles shouldn't be so earnest, he thinks. It doesn't suit them. "Well, that's fine," he says. "I prefer coffee anyways. May I have a cup, please, ma'am? Black with three sugars, okay?" He reaches for the chipped porcelain, and the girl yelps and bats his hand away. A deep, angry buzzing comes from underneath the inverted cup. "Jesus, what do you got in there?" "It's not a tea party. It's a circus." "That's so." He turns on his smile, the goofy one that says he doesn't take himself too seriously, and neither should you. But the back of his hand stings where she smacked him. She glares at him suspiciously, not for who he might be, what he might do to her, but because she is irritated that he doesn't understand. He looks around more carefully and recognizes it now, her ramshackle circus, the big top ring marked out with a finger traced in the dirt, a tightrope made from a flattened drinking straw rigged between two soda cans, the Ferris wheel of the dented bicycle wheel, half propped up against a bush, with a rock to hold it in place, and paper people torn out of magazines, jammed between the spokes. It doesn't escape him that the rock holding it up is the perfect fit for his fist, or just how easily one of those needle spokes would slide right through the girl's eye like jello. He squeezes hard on the plastic pony in his pocket. The furious buzzing coming from underneath the cup is a vibration he can feel all the way down his vertebra, tugging at his groin. The cup jolts, and the girl clamps her hands over it. "Whoa," she laughs, breaking the spell. "Whoa, indeed, you got a lion in there?" He nudges her with his shoulder, and a smile breaks through her scowl, but only a little one. "You an animal tamer? You gonna make it jump through flaming hoops?" She grins, the polka dots of her freckles drawing up into Dutch apple cheeks, revealing bright white teeth. "Now, Rachel says I'm not allowed to play with matches. Not after last time." She has one skewed canine, slightly overlapping her incisors, and the smile more than makes up for the Brackwater brown eyes, because now he can see the spark behind them. It gives him that falling away feeling in his chest, and he's sorry he ever doubted the house. She's the one. One of the ones. His shining girls.
It's amazing, you know, we don't know it yet, but you've just set up the whole story in those first few paragraphs.
Thank you.
These two characters, Harper Curtis, I guess, and Kirby Mazraki?
Yep.
They are the really the central characters in your story. Tell me a little bit about what happens to them after this day when she's a girl and he's grown.
Well, the pony in his pocket is actually an impossible present, because this particular event happens in 1974, but the pony is from 1982. It's a My Little Pony. It's Butterscotch. And he tells her that he's going to come back for it. And he does in 1989 when he comes back to try and kill her. And this is what he does. He has a house which opens onto other times, and it allows him to hunt the woman he defines as his shining girls through time across decades. And he comes to kill her, and for one reason or another, he doesn't succeed, and he doesn't know that she survived. But this completely overturns her entire life, and she becomes absolutely obsessed with finding the man who did this to her, turning the hunt around on him, and stopping him. So they're kind of two characters caught in twin obsessions. It's almost a death duel. And eventually he will figure out that she's actually survived and come back for her.
And as in a lot of stories of serial killers, there are others who didn't survive. You have to know that he succeeded in this same process, finding a little girl and finding the little girl grown up and killing her.
Yep. It was quite traumatic to write, actually.
I can imagine. When did the idea come to you?
You know, writers spend a lot of time messing around on Twitter, and sometimes that pays off because I was bantering with a random stranger and I threw out the idea in the middle of a conversation, hey, you know, I should write a book about a time-traveling serial killer. And I thought, wait, I really should. That would be great. I could do something really fun with that. And I quickly deleted the tweet and I started writing the book on the plane, and I had this opening chapter, you know, come to me immediately as a very strong kind of central image. And I always know my beginnings and my endings. It's kind of figuring out the in-between stuff, which is where the magic comes in. But it's, so that's where it came from. But I knew I wanted to set it in the 20th century and look at how the loops of history come up again and again. You know, it's a time travel book. There are loops. There are paradoxes. But it's also about history.
I guess the time travel loops are part of the fascination of it. But did you know right away? I mean, were you planning to write a book about a serial killer?
No, I've never had a particular interest in serial killers. I'm not one of those serial killer junkies. I've watched a lot of serial killer movies, and I think some of the better ones do it very, very well, from Silence of the Lambs through to Seven. But it wasn't something I had a particular fascination with. And, you know, I think a lot of what I'm doing, I hope, is kind of subverting the traditions of the genre, you know, and making it much more about the victims, who are normally just pretty corpses or bloody puzzles, and making it much more about the woman than the actual killer.
Well, and of course, in this case, it's not just a woman, it's many women. It's the shining girls. They are all shining girls, and you mean shining in a very particular sense, don't you?
I do. A lot of serial killers have a type. You know, Ted Bundy went for a young woman with long brown hair and a middle parting. And Harper Curtis's type is that he looks for women who have a spark inside them, a burning potential. You know, there's a fire in their guts, and he can't stand it. They're all kicking back against their social context in some way or another. And he's driven to kill them because of it.
Does he have some particular experience, or is that asking you too much to know why he can't stand that spark?
Well, he stumbles upon this house, and the woman's names are actually written on the wall, waiting for him. So it's kind of a play on time travel and fatalism, destiny. It's, it becomes a kind of a puzzle that he's fallen into himself. But he was certainly a violent man before this. You know, there was certainly a precedent. This is just what nudged him, you know, through the final door. He was involved in World War I, and he was complicit in his brother getting very, very badly hurt. He's always been a bad kid, a vile, violent man.
I have to confess that when I saw the title of the book first, The Shining, and then I saw the girls, I thought immediately of Stephen King. Was that in your mind when you called them the Shining Girls?
It wasn't in my mind when I called. I mean, it obviously, you know, in the title, it is obviously some kind of reflection of The Shining. And the house that Harper finds has similar qualities to the Overlook Hotel. And I was a Stephen King fan. It wasn't something I specifically set out to do. The fact that they shone in the book, that this was the quality that Harper looked for, happened to be there already. And then it just made a better title. The original title was The Killing Time, which is just a terrible pun. So The Shining Girls is much, much better.
Indeed, much better. One of the things that I suspect must have been very hard for you, though I don't know, is that you really describe these murders graphically. There is gory detail after gory detail. I guess it would have been hard for me. I don't know whether it was for you.
It was. And, you know, I think there are some people who have found the violence shocking. But you know what? It's supposed to be shocking because real violence is shocking. And I need you to remember that because we're so inured to death. We're so inured to violence. We're so inured to serial killers that I needed to jolt you out of that. And actually, I think a lot of that response comes from the fact that it's actually, the deaths are actually quite emotional because they're from the woman's perspective. And you're with her at the end. You're not riding along on the serial killer's shoulder, complicit in the action, kind of getting off on the sick thrill of getting the knife in. You are with the young woman. And it's her shock and her outrage and her fear and how dare you do this to me. And, oh my God, he just stabbed me. And it's that reality. And I wanted it to be real because I think it's too easy to write that very glibly and to make death meaningless and to make it just another dead body. So it is supposed to be upsetting. I tried not to go into too much detail, but there are one or two, you know, kind of shocking lines and vivid imagery to jar you specifically.
One of the other reasons I think it's so hard to read is that the characters are so real. You spent a lot of time developing the individual, the victims of this, the Shining Girls. I wonder if, would you be willing to talk about a couple of them? There's a young single mom welder, for instance.
Yeah, Zora. She's one of my favorite characters. She's absolutely wonderful, if I can say so myself. She's an African-American welder in 1943. Her husband was a ship's electrician, and he died in the war. The Nazis got his ship. And she's now kind of put herself into self-exile in a small town called Seneca, just outside of Chicago, and she's working at the Chicago Bridge and Iron Company as a welder, building the gun turrets in some kind of way of getting revenge. But she's isolated herself so much from her friends and family that she's really only the black woman, the only black woman in the whole town. And she has to live far out of town with her family because there are just no facilities available for coloreds. And this is based on kind of real history. You know, I actually had a Chicago historian look into it for me, and there were no African-Americans in Seneca at that time at all. So I kind of really wanted to play up that level of, racial segregation and the fact that Jim Crow was still very much alive and well, even during World War II. But she, you know, she's very strong and fiery, and, she's trying to make a living for her family. And then Harper comes for her the one night. So, you know, it was very difficult creating these deep, rich portraits of interesting, fascinating, sparking women and then killing them.
Yeah, you come up with these people that you begin to really care about, which makes their deaths that much more vivid. And in some of them, there's a dancer, for instance, who paints herself with radium paint. She probably didn't know that was going to kill her anyway. So it's not, you can't say that Harper did her a favor, but at the same time, you know that she was already killing herself.
Absolutely. And that was actually based on a real story that one of my researchers found for me in the Milwaukee Sentinel from 1936 of a young woman who was in hospital for radiation burns. And she was a burlesque dancer who painted herself in radium paint. And I actually lifted some of the lines of dialogue with permission from the Milwaukee Sentinel piece because she has this wonderful, crazy French accent. You know, she's like, oh, tell the boys they must not be frightened of me. And she was just a wonderful character in real life, and I fictionalized all the details and brought her forward to 1931 and claimed her for my own. But it was amazing to see real history, and, you know, I think this is something journalism has taught me, is that real life is often more inventive and surprising than anything you could make up.
And of course, in this case, you care about her doubly because you care that you get to know her, you care that she's using the stuff that is killing her even though she didn't know, and then you care because Harper kills her. That's just, and then there's Kirby. We shouldn't forget Kirby. Kirby is essential to the whole thing. You don't know whether to be happy or sad that she survived the killing because it's so disturbing for her.
It is. It destroys her entire life, and she has these very visible scars. You know, he tried to slit her throat, and she has this scar right across her throat, and she has to hide it with a scarf. And everywhere she goes, people think of her as that girl. You know, it's almost a kind of twisted celebrity. And she has to live with it, and it gets in the way of her, like, forming relationships with people. And until she meets Dan, who is kind of her mentor and sidekick at the Chicago Sun-Times. And But, you know, this whole thing has just derailed her entire life. And there's kind of a lovely relationship developing between her and Dan, but she won't let it because she's so obsessed and single-minded about finding the man who did this to her.
Well, but he's obsessed by it as well, partly on her behalf, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, I think he's kind of obsessed with her. I think he's really trying to help her and trying to see her through.
Why, by the way, did you go to Chicago for this? You're South African. You can tell by listening to you that that's the part of the world you know best. But you chose 20th century Chicago. There must have been a reason.
I specifically didn't want to write about apartheid. I have tackled apartheid in both my previous books. But if you're looking at a history of the 20th century, America just gives you a much brighter... I'm going to say that again. Sorry.
It's okay. Go ahead.
If you're looking at the 20th century, America just gives you a much broader scope. There's much more range to play with in terms of looking at everything from how highways have reshaped cities to how McCarthyism and the war on, you know, the Red Scare is an echo of the war on terror that we have today with paranoia festering and being used to erode our rights. And there were all these kind of loops and interesting threads that I wanted to pick out. Women's rights, the Great Depression, you know, all kinds of things. And if I'd said it in South Africa, apartheid would have just overshadowed everything. And it would have had to become essentially about that. So I specifically chose Chicago because it was a city I'd lived in. And, you know, in South Africa, we like to think that we do things best, that we have the best corruption, and we have the best violent crime, and we have the best segregation. But, you know, some American cities do it pretty well, too.
Yeah. You also kept it in the 20th century, which is nice in a way because it gives you the ability to do things that you can research. It's not pretending to understand the future.
Absolutely. And, my previous book, Moxieland, dealt with a kind of near future under a corporate apartheid system. So I have played with the future before, but I think there's a thread in all my books about the ghosts of the past and the ghosts of history that come up again and again. And it's something, I think it's a major theme in my work, something I'm fascinated with.
The other thing about doing it in Chicago, even though you did live there, is that there had to have been an incredible amount of research. If you're going to cover a whole century and go to different parts of it, if you're going to go to the Great Depression, if you're going to look into the birth control clinics of the 1970s, you must have had to do an enormous amount of reading.
There was a ton of reading, watching YouTube videos, and the amount of research which would go into like one line, you know, about what the landing ship tanks look like when they launch sideways into the river from the Chicago Bridge and Iron Company, or whether they had paper planes in 1931, or, you know, what the Jane Abortion Group used. There was a ton of research. I worked with two young researchers who were amazing, and they would get the finicky little details for me, like what a 1931 hospital looked like, how much they would charge, how they would fix a ripped tendon, for example. But, there was a ton of reading, lots of watching documentaries and online YouTube videos. I went back to Chicago. I location scouted. I interviewed a Chicago police detective who took me down to the local station. We went through boxes of old evidence and discussed what Kirby would and would not have had access to. I met with sports reporters. I went to Wrigley Field. I location scouted the place where Kirby is attacked in Montrose Beach. And just really dug deep.
And at the same time, you had to be so very careful about properly placed anachronisms.
Exactly. Because Harper leaves weird items on each woman. He takes an item from each woman and leaves it behind on another, which is, of course, how Kirby starts putting the mystery together. And it was also interesting to research that. You know, like one of the items is a tape from 1972. And I had to do a lot of digging to see whether that was feasible, whether somebody would have had a pirated cassette tape of Janis Joplin in 1972. And I eventually found adverts of cassette players from 1972, which suggested that it was actually, you know, maybe a little bit cutting edge, but popular enough that she might have had access to it.
The other thing that must have been disturbing about this is that you not only set yourself a mystery to explain, but it had to be a non-linear mystery. You have him popping up in different places. The same thing that Kirby had to track, you had to track. Did you have maps on the wall or something?
I did. I had a murder wall, and it tracks Harper's timeline, which, of course, is impossible for any detective to kind of piece together because his MO is all over the place. He's more violent in 1984 and less violent in 1993 because that's not the order he's killing in. And so there's his killing timeline with all the objects that he leaves behind and takes from the girls. There's the actual book's timeline, which switches decades and perspectives. And there's the historical timeline. So I had to track all of that with red strings and all the photographs I'd taken in Chicago and you know, evocative images or reference pictures of everything from a wired jaw through to, you know, Buckingham Fountain frozen over.
You never actually explain, do you, how the house functions, how it is a time portal?
I don't explain how it is a time portal, but I do explain why it is a time portal.
That there's a feeling that, well, that it may not be, that these may just be the strangeness of Harper's mind.
It could be.
Okay, we won't pursue that one. What do you think it is about time travel that has such a resonance for readers?
I think it's fun. You know, I think, especially when you're dealing, you know, I could have written Bill and Ted's excellent killing spree, and we could have jumped from killing cavemen to killing Shakespeare to killing Hitler. But I specifically wanted to do a more serious book which examined more serious issues, or I'd like to hope it's a more serious book. And time travel, you know, wild conceits like time travel, or in my previous books, magical animals that attach themselves to criminals, or kind of a near future where we're controlled by our cell phones, which is not at all like our current reality. it allows you a way to play with current issues. And we have such issue fatigue. You know, I mean, every time Syria comes on the news, it's just so overwhelming. And it's so much to deal with. You just kind of want to change the channel. And as a South African, you know, the Oscar Pistorius case, you know, talking about violence against women, it's just horrific. And you get sick of it. And you just want to change the channel and look away. And I think fiction, and especially inventive, strange, playful fiction, just gives you enough of a twist on reality that it makes it fresh again, that you can get into those issues from a different angle. It's like a distorting mirror, which makes things more clear.
You can also go behind them. This is a discussion that raises big questions like free will and determinism, because we like the safety of linear thinking, don't we?
Absolutely. And yeah, it does. You know, I think Harper is someone who's trapped by his fate, and Kirby's someone who's defied it. And you know, the jumping around, it almost then also becomes a puzzle for the reader to solve as well.
I noticed that Leonardo DiCaprio's company has purchased the rights to The Shining Girls. It's hard to imagine how that's going to work. Do you have any idea?
Well, I think the way they pitched it to me was as a 13-hour movie, which really allows you to get into the character of the girls. And I think that's partly what makes this book, that's why people have responded to this book the way they have, because of the characters of the woman.
A 13-hour movie, a TV series.
A TV series, yeah. Yeah. Sorry, yes, I didn't explain that. It's been optioned as a TV series, so it'll be 13 hours kind of, and you know, really just letting you dig deep into the story and really get a sense of the characters and have the mystery unfolding. You know, and it's with MRC, who did House of Cards with David Fincher. And
oh, so
Ken
in some
Spacey,
ways it would be a 13-hour movie.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that was tremendously exciting to me, and that kind of forward thinking that MRC is doing, where they released House of Cards straight to Netflix. I think that's a really bold and brave and exciting move.
You have another novel out, I guess, called, or you're about to come out, called Broken Monsters. You've given up on Chicago and you're moving to Detroit.
Moved to Detroit.
Have you lived
moved
there?
Moved on. No, I haven't. I've been there on a research trip. It's very important to me, because I was a journalist for so long, to actually visit the locations that I'm writing about. And I've interviewed a lot of people, and I've got a lot of people in Detroit who will be reading the book. It's not coming out yet. It'll only be out next year. I'm still in the throes of writing it at the moment, but I'll have a lot of people reading it to make sure that I get the Detroit details right. You know, I think as a South African, having seen South Africa misrepresented so horribly in all kinds of media, it's really important to me to be authentic and to have a book that locals can read and say, yeah, she did a pretty good job.
We've talked about how The Shining brings up the subject of Stephen King. I read somewhere that you've described your new novel as a cross between Stephen King and Jennifer Egan. Did you mean that?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm aiming for. I hope it turns out that way. You know, I think what Jennifer Egan does at getting to the heart of who we are as people and kind of our relationships, and then Stephen King just writes amazing characters, but also just, you know, darkness and madness and really sly, subversive, distorting of reality. I find that very, very interesting. So that's what I'm aiming for. We'll see if I pull it off.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks so much. No, it's been great.
Very nice. Thank you. You are
awesome.
You are superb.
Thank you very much. Hooray.
Thanks. Well, I hope to say hi to your daughter. Or is it?
It is a daughter, yeah.
Phew, I got it right. Anyway,
thanks. And to answer your question, I mean, that, you know, it is, the house is kind of Harper's subconscious to a certain extent. But, you know, I mean, it's his ghost. He's trapped in hell. He's going to be stuck in this loop forever. He's possessing the house and he's calling himself back to it so that he can fulfill his destiny forever and ever and ever and ever. It's Promethean.
Oh, frightening.
Yeah. So. Well,
wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Cool. All right, brilliant.
All right. Bye-bye.
Ciao.